Welcome to Lessons in Tanya, Chapter 29. All right, let's dive into something truly profound today. We're venturing into Chapter 29 of Tanya, building directly on our previous explorations. For those maybe newer to these deep dives, Tanya is this foundational text in Chabad philosophy, written by Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Liadi, the Alter Rebbe, the old Rebbe as he's known. It's really a guide to understanding the soul, achieving spiritual connection.
It really is a roadmap in many ways.
Yeah. And in chapters 26 through 28, we talk quite a bit about overcoming that state of, well, spiritual low, sometimes called depression, that heavy feeling.
Right, the sluggishness that just stops you in your tracks, spiritually speaking.
Exactly, prevents you from really engaging.
Yeah.
But today, we're shifting focus. It's another big internal challenge, but it feels different. It's what's known as dullness of heart.
Kimtum halef.
Right. And it's not just a fleeting bad mood, you know, a bit of an off day.
No, not at all.
The Alter Rebbe presents it as this really profound inner state, almost like a spiritual insensitivity settling deep inside.
That's a good way to put it. Insensitivity.
So our mission, really, in this deep dive is to understand this state better. And crucially, to unpack the powerful, sometimes even radical strategies the Alter Rebbe gives for dealing with it.
And what's really intriguing, I think, is that he introduces this specifically for people on what he calls the intermediate spiritual level.
Okay, let's clarify that. Intermediate doesn't mean average, does it?
No, definitely not mediocre. In Tanya, this intermediate person is deeply committed. They're striving constantly to do good. They're involved in divine service. They meticulously avoid doing wrong.
So they're really working at it.
Oh, absolutely. They've made real progress. But, and this is the key, they haven't yet completely transformed their innate, sometimes self-serving impulses, what the text calls the animal soul.
Ah, right. That part of us focused on, well, more basic desires.
Exactly. They still feel its pull, those lower desires, even if they fight them off and don't act on them. And for them, this dullness of heart is a particular hurdle.
So what does it actually mean for someone like that if they're trying so hard?
Well, it's not just feeling uninspired. It's a profound insensitivity, like we said. The inability to fully connect emotionally with spiritual truths, even when their mind gets it completely.
So the head understands, but the heart isn't feeling it.
Precisely. It's that emotional disconnect from the very things they know are true and vital. The feeling just isn't there.
So what does this look like in practice? This dullness. You mentioned insensitivity.
Well, the text uses this really vivid image. Imagine your heart turning to stone.
Wow. That's stark.
It is. And it's not just poetry. It shows up in very real ways. A primary impact the text highlights is the inability to genuinely open your heart in prayer.
Okay. Which, as we know, prayer isn't just reading words off a page.
Absolutely not.
It's meant to be the service of the heart, right? That's the phrase used.
Exactly. It's that internal process, connecting, pouring out your soul, feeling that deep resonance with the divine.
But if your heart is like stone, dull. Yeah.
That connection just doesn't happen. The emotional channel is blocked. You might go through the motions, say the words, but that profound inner experience, it's missing.
Like trying to sing with laryngitis, maybe. Or paint with a numb hand.
Good analogies. The instrument, the heart itself, is unresponsive.
Okay. And this connects to the dual nature of prayer you were mentioning earlier.
Yes, precisely. Prayer is complex. It operates on two levels, both involving the heart. First, prayer takes place in the heart.
Meaning,
our intellectual grasp of the divine, you know, understanding divine oneness or love or awe, that understanding needs to go beyond just the brain. It has to descend into our emotions.
Become a felt reality.
Exactly. Cultivating genuine love, genuine awe right there in the heart, not just thinking about love and awe.
Got it. And the second level?
The second level is that the object of prayer is the heart itself. Prayer aims to transform the heart, purify it, by steering it away from mundane, self-centered inclinations, redirecting it towards a real yearning for the spiritual, for the divine. It's about refining our emotional landscape, aligning our deepest desires with holiness.
So it works in the heart and on the heart.
You got it. And when the heart is dull, like stone,
both become incredibly hard.
Or impossible. It's like trying to fill a leaky bucket, like you said. The understanding, the spiritual light, it just doesn't stick. The heart can't receive it properly.
And this impact, this heart of stone, it goes beyond just prayer time, doesn't it? It affects everyday life, too.
Oh, absolutely. It ripples out. This heaviness in the heart has another critical effect, especially for that intermediate person we're talking about.
Which is?
It prevents them from effectively waging their inner war against the evil impulse. And here's a fascinating part. even in matters that are technically permitted.
Right, we touched on this before. The intermediate person's job isn't just avoiding outright sin.
Which they do, meticulously.
But it's also about controlling desires in permitted areas, like not eating the second you feel hungry, or delaying gratification.
Exactly. Not indulging permitted pleasures to excess. It requires this constant internal battle, right?
Yeah.
A struggle against gratifying every whim instantly.
It's about self-mastery in the small things.
Yes. But when the heart is dull, heavy, insensitive, that battle becomes almost impossible.
Why? What's the connection?
You just don't have the spiritual sensitivity or the emotional drive to fight it. You can't fight a spiritual war with a numb heart. It's like trying to push a boulder uphill when you feel completely drained and disconnected. You lack the leverage, the inner fire.
So what's the ultimate root cause of this? Why does the heart become dull?
Well, the source tells us pretty directly. It says the light of the soul, which includes that intellectual understanding of the divine, it doesn't penetrate the body properly because of the body's coarseness.
Coarseness, like physical density. Or something else.
It's more like a spiritual density, a lack of refinement. But it's not just about not understanding. You might understand perfectly in your head.
Right.
The problem is the understanding isn't getting implanted deeply enough. It's not overcoming the coarseness of the heart and body. Mm-hmm. It stays sort of superficial, intellectually grasped, but not emotionally integrated.
Okay. And what causes that blockage?
The text identifies the ultimate cause as the arrogance of the other side. That's the animal soul again.
Arrogance. How so?
It actively exalts itself. It essentially thinks it's better, more real, more important than the holiness of the divine soul within you.
Wow.
And in doing that, it obscures the divine soul's light. It darkens it. Think of it like a really thick spiritual smog.
Blocking the connection.
Exactly. Preventing clarity, connection, emotional receptivity. It's a self-aggrandizing spiritual ego that says, I am. And in doing so, it blocks the light that says only the divine truly is. That arrogance is the root.
Okay, so we've got the problem. This inner dullness, this spiritual concrete. And we've got the root cause, the arrogance of the other side. Now, the million-dollar question. How do we breakthrough.
Right. How do we deal with it? And this is where it gets really interesting, maybe even challenging. The Alter Rebbe quotes the Zohar, the ancient mystical text.
And what does the Zohar say?
It gives this pretty startling piece of advice. It says, a wooden beam which does not catch fire should be splintered.
Okay.
And similarly, a body into which the light of the soul does not penetrate should be crushed.
Crushed. Splintered. That sounds intense.
It is intense. The analogy is powerful. You don't just keep trying to light the damp wood. You break it down. You splinter it to expose the dry core, remove the resistance.
So applied to the heart.
It means this dullness, this tintum halev, has to be eradicated by dealing with its root cause, that arrogance, not just by piling on more intellectual study, hoping it will eventually break through.
You have to dismantle the wall, not just push against it.
Exactly. You have to break down the resistance itself.
But crushing the body or the spirit, that leads to this really profound point about identity, doesn't it? Especially for the intermediate person.
Yes, absolutely. The text explains that for this intermediate individual, the animal soul often is the very man himself.
Meaning their sense of self is wrapped up in it.
To a large degree, yes. When they think or say I, they're often identifying with this vital soul that animates the body, the source of their drives and inclinations. So crushing one's spirit in this context really means crushing the arrogance of that other side, which they perceive as themselves.
It's tackling their perceived core self.
Right. Now contrast that with someone the text calls completely righteous.
Okay. How are they different?
For them, the pure soul, the divine soul, is the man himself. Their sense of I is fully identified with their divine essence. The body and the animal soul are seen as secondary, almost external.
Like tools or garments.
Exactly. The text refers to their body as the flesh of man. There's that famous example of Hillel the Elder.
Oh, right. Good to eat.
Yes. He tells students he was going to do a favor to the lowly and poor creature, meaning his body.
He saw it as something separate, needing care, but not him.
Precisely. Because his true essence was the divine soul, which had already transformed the animal soul's negativity into good. It had subsumed it.
But for the intermediate person, that transformation isn't complete.
Not yet. The animal soul is still distinct, still powerful, still deeply intertwined with their sense of self, which makes this crushing process very personal, sometimes uncomfortable, but ultimately necessary for growth.
So let's get practical. What does this crushing the other side actually look like for the intermediate person? It sounds harsh.
It does sound harsh. The method prescribed is setting aside specific times for deep self-reflection aimed at humbling oneself, to genuinely consider oneself in certain aspects despicable and contemptible.
Okay, that's where people might push back. We hear so much about self-esteem. How is this not just, you know, beating yourself up? Isn't it counterproductive?
That's a crucial point. It's not about wallowing or self-hatred for its own sake. It's a targeted spiritual exercise.
Targeted at what?
Targeted specifically at the arrogance of the animal soul, which is the root cause of the dullness. The text says a broken heart leads to a broken spirit. The spirit being broken here is the other side, that haughty ego.
So it's about breaking the pride that hardens the heart.
Exactly. By engaging in reflection that leads to genuine humility, you dismantle the very thing that's blocking the light. It's strategic, not just emotional flagellation.
All right. So what kind of reflections lead to this state constructively?
The Alter Rebbe provides several lines of reasoning, powerful ways to think about this. First, contemplating the chasm of remoteness.
Being.
If you identify primarily with the animal soul, which, as we said, is often the case for the intermediate person, you have to recognize how incredibly distant that makes you from the divine, spiritually speaking.
Even if you're not actually sinning.
Even then, because the animal soul, by its nature, isn't inherently repulsed by forbidden things. The intermediate person stops themselves, they suppress the impulse, but the fact that the impulse could arise, that a forbidden desire might even have some fleeting appeal.
That itself shows a distance from pure holiness.
Exactly. It's a stark recognition of the part of you that's fundamentally aligned differently, far from sanctity. It's not about shame, but clear-eyed awareness of the inner adversary.
Okay, what's the next line of reasoning? This one sounds even tougher.
It is provocative. The idea that in this specific aspect, one is inferior to and more loathsome and abominable than unclean animals and insects and reptiles.
Whoa. Okay. How do we understand that without just feeling crushed in a bad way? It seems to go against basic human dignity.
The spiritual logic is key here. Those creatures act according to their nature. They don't have moral choice. They don't transgress the divine will designed for them.
They just are what they are.
Right. But a human, given free choice, can choose to entertain thoughts or desires that go against the divine will, even if not acted upon. The text quotes King David, "But I am a worm and not a man."
So the point isn't literal self-loathing.
No. It's the profound realization that using your God-given agency, your choice, to align even mentally with something contrary to the divine makes you, in that specific way, lower than a creature that simply follows its created nature without that choice. It highlights the immense responsibility of human consciousness. It's meant to induce profound humility, not despair.
Okay, that clarifies it somewhat. What else?
Third, reflecting on the transient nature of spiritual highs. Even when you feel incredibly inspired during prayer, feeling intense love for the divine.
Those amazing moments of connection.
Yes, but for the intermediate person, that feeling often fades quickly afterwards. It's real during prayer, they can genuinely generate it, but it lacks constancy. It doesn't permeate their whole life.
So the fact that it comes and goes shows the other side isn't fully subdued.
Precisely. It shows the animal soul can still reassert its influence, its coarseness, once the intense focus of prayer is removed. The high is real, but not absolute or permanent yet.
All right. And the fourth line of reasoning.
This one involves reflecting on the timeless stain of past misdeeds. The contamination from past actions, even sins of youth, and the blemish they caused in the spiritual worlds.
But what if someone has repented sincerely? Doesn't that erase the past?
Repentance is incredibly powerful, yes. But the text emphasizes that the essence of repentance is in the heart, and there are many, many levels. Its effectiveness can depend on your spiritual level, the time, the place. And crucially, in the higher spiritual realms, time doesn't operate like it does here. A past misdeed retains a kind of spiritual presence.
So its effect lingers spiritually.
In a sense. So if you're experiencing this dullness of heart, this lack of penetration of spiritual light, it could mean one of two things. Either the current level of repentance hasn't quite broken through that barrier yet, or more profoundly, it could be that the divine actually wants to elevate you to a higher, more sublime level of repentance, coming from an even deeper place in your heart.
So the dullness isn't necessarily rejection, but an invitation to go deeper.
Exactly. It's not divine displeasure. It's a call to deeper growth. That's why King David, who was completely righteous, kept his past sin constantly before me. not because he wasn't forgiven, but to constantly push himself to greater heights of holiness, deeper humility.
Using the past as fuel for present growth.
Precisely. It's a continuous catalyst.
This is really deep. So what about someone who feels, okay, maybe I didn't commit huge sins in my youth, but they still feel that dullness and want to cultivate this broken spirit, this humility?
That's where the Zohar's advice to become a master of accounts comes in.
A spiritual audit.
A very rigorous one. You're the proprietor, the owner, taking full responsibility, not just a hired bookkeeper passively recording.
Meaning?
Taking comprehensive, utterly honest stock of all your thoughts, words, and actions from the moment you came into being until right now.
Every single one.
That's the ideal. And asking, was it oriented towards holiness, towards the divine, his will, his service, or was it oriented towards the other side?
And other side here means more than just obvious evil, right?
Much more. It's anything not consciously directed towards the divine. Seemingly neutral things, idle thoughts, pointless conversations, actions done purely for physical pleasure without higher intent.
Even those can fall into the other side's domain if not elevated.
That's the implication. Because if it's not for holiness, its energy defaults, so to speak, to the side of mundanity or self-centeredness, which is the realm of the other side.
Wow. That changes how you look at every moment, doesn't it? It's not just about avoiding bad deeds, but actively directing everything.
Well, it forces a profound reevaluation. It makes you realize the spiritual weight and alignment of seemingly insignificant moments.
It's a huge undertaking, this accounting.
It is, and it goes even deeper. The text explains that when you engage in holy thoughts, words, or actions, you literally become a vehicle for holiness, drawing down spiritual energy.
Connected to higher realms.
Yes. And conversely, impure thoughts or actions, or even those neutral, undirected ones, make you an unclean vehicle for the other side, for impurity. You align yourself with those forces.
So even small moments of distraction have a spiritual consequence.
They contribute to the overall spiritual landscape of your being. And another surprising area for this self-accounting, dreams.
Dreams? How do they fit in?
The source suggests dreams can reveal our unconscious state, our hidden attachments, sometimes more clearly than waking thoughts.
Really? I thought dreams were mostly just random noise.
Well, the text says most dreams are vanity and an affliction of the spirit, precisely because the soul isn't usually ascending purely during sleep. Only the truly pure, it says, ascend cleanly.
So for most people.
For most people, the other side can latch on, filling dreams with mundane worries, nonsensical images, false scenarios, even disturbing things.
So analyzing your dreams can be part of this self-humbling.
Yes, because they can reveal areas needing work, hidden desires, unresolved issues, attachments that we might not be conscious of. Even for someone who hasn't overtly sinned, dreams can offer insights for this process.
So contemplating all this, the remoteness, the comparison to lower creatures, the transience of highs, past deeds, the moment-by-moment accounting, even dreams.
The deeper you go, the more you contemplate these ideas, delving into the writings, the more your heart naturally breaks. You start to feel genuinely shamed and despised in the face of divine truth, potentially even despising the life led by the animal soul.
And that intense feeling is the goal.
That feeling, that brokenness, is what degrades and casts down the haughtiness of the other side. It dismantles the arrogance that caused the dullness in the first place, making the heart soft and receptive again. It sounds harsh, but it's presented as a necessary spiritual surgery.
Okay. That's one path, the deep, reflective, humbling path. But you mentioned the Alter Rebbe offers a second method.
Yes, a more active one. Directly thundering against the other side with a strong, raging voice.
Raging, like getting angry.
Not outward anger at people. This is an internal mental confrontation, a focused, intense indignation directed squarely at the animal soul within you.
So an inner battle cry.
Kind of. The sages taught a person should always rouse the good impulse against the evil impulse. And they cite the verse, rage and sin not.
So the rage is directed inward at the impulse itself.
Exactly. When you feel that pull towards dullness, doubt, lethargy, or some unwanted desire, you don't just passively observe it. You mentally turn on it with force.
You fight back internally.
With inner fury.
How does that actually work? What do you, like, say to yourself?
It's a direct internal dialogue. You address your animal soul in your mind with fierce indignation. You are truly evil. Wicked, abominable, loathsome, disgraceful.
Using all those strong terms the sages use.
Yes, defining it clearly as the adversary, separate from your true self, externalizing it. Then you challenge its very audacity. How long, you demand, will you obscure the light of the blessed infinite?
The divine light that's everywhere.
Precisely. Which pervades all worlds. Which was, is, and will be the same, even right here where I stand.
You're reminding it and yourself of the ultimate reality.
Exactly. You're stating the truth. The divine light is everywhere, unchanged by creation. I, the divine, have not changed, as the verse says. And the other side, in its arrogance, basically denies this. It pretends separation and self-importance exist.
It creates an illusion.
Yes. And this internal raging, this forceful assertion of truth, does something remarkable. It helps the divine soul enlighten its eyes.
Enlighten its eyes, meaning?
It shifts perception. You begin to perceive the truth of divine unity, not just intellectually, not just by hearing about it, but almost as if with physical sight, an experiential knowing.
A deeper level of awareness.
Much deeper. And this sight leads naturally to self-nullification before the divine. The ego, the arrogance of the other side just dissolves in the face of that perceived reality. It's a profound shift.
So these two methods, the deep humbling and the direct raging, why are they so effective? What's the underlying principle?
The underlying reason is absolutely fundamental and actually quite liberating. In ultimate truth, the other side has no inherent substance of its own.
No real power.
Not intrinsically. It's compared to darkness. Darkness isn't a thing. It's just the absence of light.
Right. Turn on a light, the darkness is gone instantly.
Exactly. You don't fight darkness. You introduce light. Similarly, the other side, despite seeming powerful, despite having all this vitality.
Where does it get that vitality from then, if it has no substance itself?
That's the crucial point. Its vitality isn't its own. It's borrowed. It ultimately originates from the realm of holiness. The divine is the only true source of all life, all energy.
So even the other side is sustained by divine energy.
Fundamentally, yes. Which means in the presence of true holiness, when divine truth and light are revealed, the other side is automatically nullified, like darkness before light.
But then why does it seem so powerful? Why does it even exist?
Ah, the big question. The text clarifies. The divine allows it, grants it permission and the ability to puff itself up, to elevate itself against the holiness of the divine soul within a person.
As a test.
As a deliberate design.
Yeah.
A test, a challenge. It's there specifically so that you are roused to overpower it, to humble it. Through humility, self-reflection, internal raging, you deflate its arrogance.
And when we do that,
there's a principle. Arousal from below brings arousal from above. Your effort, your internal work to crush the other side, it triggers a response from the divine.
What kind of response?
The divine essentially brings it down, withdraws its power, removes its dominion. It makes the illusion vanish, just like turning on the light. Your struggle activates divine assistance to dispel the darkness.
That's a powerful framework. It puts the agency back with us, but with divine help.
Exactly. It's a partnership in overcoming the illusion.
Is there a historical example that really shows this in action, how quickly that illusion can collapse?
Yes, a classic and very powerful one. The story of the scouts, the spies, sent by Moses into the Holy Land.
Ah, right. The negative report.
Initially, 10 of them came back terrified. They said, "For he, the enemy, is stronger than we."
Which the sages interpreted even more strongly.
As meaning stronger than the divine. A shocking lack of faith in divine power to help them conquer the land. It plunged the people into despair.
A total collapse of faith.
Yeah.
But then, didn't they suddenly change their tune?
Almost immediately, they reverse completely, saying, "We will readily go up."
So what happened? Did Moses show them a new sign? Did the enemies suddenly weaken?
No, nothing external changed. All Moses did was convey the divine's intense anger and the oath that, because of their disbelief, that generation wouldn't enter the land.
But wait, if they didn't believe in the divine's power in the first place, why would divine anger suddenly convince them? It seems illogical.
It does seem illogical on the surface, but the explanation gets to the core of what we've been discussing. As believers, descendants of believers, their inner essence, their divine soul, never stopped believing. It had perfect faith.
So the doubt wasn't their true self?
No. Their expressed lack of faith, their fear, was the voice of the other side temporarily cloaked in their bodies, puffing itself up with arrogant nonsense without real reason. It was an external layer, a spiritual distortion clouding their inherent truth.
Okay.
So when the divine thundered with a voice of stormy indignation through Moses' words, that intensity, that divine raging, what happened, their hearts were humbled and broken.
The arrogance shattered.
Exactly. That divine energy instantly toppled the other side from its temporary dominion. And the moment that arrogance collapsed,
their inherent faith just resurfaced.
Instantly.
Yeah.
Unclouded. And they declared, "We will readily go up. No external miracle needed." Only that confrontation, that divine raging transmitted through Moses, was enough to strip the other side of its bluster and reveal the faith beneath.
That's an amazing illustration. It shows how flimsy the other side's power really is when confronted.
Exactly. It looks formidable, but it can crumble quickly when faced with truth and divine force.
So what's the takeaway for us? For anyone listening who struggles with doubts, doubts about faith, about purpose, maybe even about their own ability to grow spiritually.
The lesson is direct. Those doubts, those whispers of inadequacy or skepticism, they're mostly just empty words of the other side.
Empty words?
Just the animal soul puffing itself up, trying to obscure your divine soul. Your essence as a spiritual being, as a believer, is pure faith. The doubts are not you. They're an external imposition, an attack trying to create that spiritual dullness.
That's incredibly reassuring. The doubts aren't the real me.
And it goes even deeper. This might sound surprising, but the text suggests that the other side itself, in its ultimate spiritual source, actually has no doubts about faith.
Wait, the source of doubt doesn't doubt. How does that work?
Its spiritual form doesn't deny divine reality, but it has been given permission by the divine to confuse humanity with false and deceitful words to increase your reward for overcoming it. It's like that analogy. A king hires a brilliant actor to try and trick his son, not because he wants the son to fail, but to test and ultimately showcase the son's wisdom and loyalty. The actor is playing a role as part of the king's plan.
So the ultimate purpose of the other side is to strengthen us through challenge.
From that ultimate cosmic perspective, yes. However, and this is a really critical distinction for practical life, when that spiritual force is clothed within a human being as our animal soul, our evil impulse,
then it is genuinely trying to mislead us.
Then its intent is truly negative. It does unequivocally aim to entice you towards things that are not good for you spiritually. The parable of the actor applies to the source, not always the immediate manifestation within us. We still have to fight the impulse seriously.
Okay, that distinction is important. Don't get complacent thinking it's all just a friendly test.
Right. But the ultimate takeaway remains incredibly empowering. Those doubts, that dullness, they're external layers. Your core, your soul, believes with perfect faith. The challenges are there to help you uncover and strengthen that unshakable core.
Wow. Okay, let's try to unpack this. What an incredibly rich, deep dive into tackling this dullness of heart. We've really explored two powerful, quite different strategies.
Yeah.
First, that path of deep intellectual humility, rigorous self-reflection, becoming that master of accounts over literally everything, thoughts, words, actions, even dreams.
Spiritual audit.
Yeah. Recognizing the spiritual dimension of every single moment.
Yeah.
And then second, that more direct, active approach, the internal confrontation,
yeah,
raging against the other side to strip away its fake power.
Yeah. The two paths, breaking the heart through humility or breaking the spirit of the other side through confrontation.
And the core insight weaving through it all is that this other side, this source of dullness and doubt, it has no real substance. Its power is borrowed. Its arrogance is an illusion.
An illusion permitted by the divine as a challenge for our growth.
Right. And when we do our part below, when we humble ourselves, when we confront it, the divine responds from above, diminishing its influence, letting our own true light shine through a heart that's no longer dull or stony.
Arousal from below brings arousal from above. Our work makes the difference.
It really does.
Yeah.
So maybe a final thought for people to ponder as they go about their week.
Okay. Here's something to chew on. We heard that even King David, utterly righteous, constantly reflected on his past sins, not out of guilt, but to push himself higher. And we heard that the other side, in the grand scheme, serves a divine purpose by presenting challenges.
Right.
So the question to ponder is this. How might you reframe the moments of dullness, the internal struggles, the doubts you face, not as signs of failure or reasons for despair, but perhaps as unique, personally tailored invitations.
Invitations to what?
Invitations to go deeper, to cultivate a more profound humility, a stronger connection, to reach for a higher level of spiritual self-mastery, one that maybe you wouldn't have reached without that specific challenge, that specific feeling of dullness pushing you to seek more light.